99%ers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, a lot's happening, as always. Let's take a look at what's happening in the U.S. and global economies. Of course, this morning, Friday, we get this abysmal jobs report, which kind of confirmed my forecast of a few weeks ago, wasn't it? If you want to see my read my piece on that, take a look at my blog, jackrasmus.com, and an article I wrote not too long ago, several weeks ago, for Telesur on is the U.S. Economy heading for a recession? Well, today we got an official 38,000 jobs created here last month in May. And we also get a downward revision on those jobs for previous months. The result of the downward revision of 59,000 jobs is that the last 3 months, the U.S. economy has only been barely adding 100,000 jobs a month. It needs somewhere between 125,000 and 150,000 every month to absorb new entrants into the labor force. Okay, so what does this portend? What does this reflect? Well, when I talked about jobs here a couple weeks ago, I indicated my concerns with these jobs numbers. Is that they are not as accurate as they should be. And why is that? Well, again, these are statistics. This isn't the actual number of jobs, the raw data on jobs. What happens is the government takes raw data and then does a number of statistical operations on the jobs to come up with this number that everyone thinks, oh, that's the number of jobs that were created or not created. No, that's the statistical estimate of the jobs. And there seems to be some kind of a problem with seasonality adjustments here, not only in jobs, but with the U.S. economy in general. Every winter, well, almost every winter, five times now, we've had, since 2010, we've had a collapse of, well, I call it a relapse. A relapse is when the growth rate drops just about to zero or close to zero. It's not a negative yet. The economy, the GDP relapses when it grows barely. And of course, the first quarter it barely grew at 0.5%. That's been estimated back up to 0.8%, which is still pretty terrible, and which always, as I say, represents about 0.3 of a percent GDP indicator over what it really is, at least, because of the way we've redefined GDP since 2013. So it really was probably statistically flat in the first quarter, and now it's probably about 0.5%, although officially 0.8. Okay, so almost every winter we get this problem going on with GDP, and we see it reflected in the jobs numbers as well. Excuse me, I got something going on here. Okay, 38,000 jobs. You could argue that the Verizon strike that was going on, just been settled, affects that number. Okay, 35,000 Verizon workers, yes, on strike. So that still gives you about 70,000 jobs only created, about half of what's normal and necessary. And others say, well, you know, we had this great winter, warm winter, especially back east, and that pulled some of the job creation going on here in the spring into the January-March period there. Yeah, you can make that argument, but you're still well below what's needed for entries into the labor force. And once again, these jobs numbers show that this problem of labor force participation, people leaving the labor force because they can't find jobs, is still with us. It's at a very low level indicates people can't find jobs and they're giving up looking for work. By the way, those numbers, too, I believe, are grossly underestimated. Those that they call the missing labor force or the discouraged workers, I don't think they're getting anywhere near the full indication to that, because the people who are mostly discouraged, a lot of them are low pay and so forth, and they don't get picked up in these monthly surveys by the household surveys, they call it, for job estimates. So they are underestimated, and I believe there's a lot more people who are in the missing labor force that the official government figures don't pick up. So labor force participation rate, showing people are leaving the labor force, is a problem. The unemployment rate, the U3 unemployment rate, actually dropped last month from 4.9 to 4.7. In other words, we didn't get much job growth, really poor job growth, but unemployment declines. Well, that can happen because of the way we in the U.S. define unemployment. You got to be out of work looking for work within the last 4 weeks, you see. And if you've given up looking for work, you aren't officially considered unemployed, according to the U3 4.7 unemployment rate. You got to understand these statistics. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on with some of this stuff. But even so, even if you say, the good weather, or the horizon strike, the numbers are still quite low. They reflect this other problem I've been talking about, in that the raw data is boosted by estimates of new business development, but those estimates for new business development reflect what's going on 9 months ago. Yeah, they bring 9 month data into the current, and they then boost the raw data, and then they do their statistical adjustments, which seasonality problems exist, and then they get the number they report to you. Well, it's kind of a rough estimate figure, really. I wouldn't go by any of these figures for jobs month to month. The only thing useful is to look at the trends, longer-term trends. And, of course, the last 3 months, we got a longer-term trend of only 116,000 jobs being created on average in the last 3 months. Clearly an indication of a slowdown. It's probably also an indication of jobs lag the real economy, and the indication that in the first quarter the U.S. economy hit a wall of sorts. Now they say that we're going to get a recovery back. I don't know here in the second quarter. If it is, it's going to be pretty weak. Another comment on these jobs numbers, and the GDP numbers. We've heard in the previous four or five, at least the last two before the most recent GDP numbers for the first quarter of this year, we've heard that, it was weak in the winter, the GDP and jobs, because of bad weather. Each time they come out with a bad weather argument, I challenge that whole idea, bad weather causing GDP to have a relapse here. In previous winter, all these relapses always come in the winter. That implies that there is a seasonality problem going on here, estimate problem. But we didn't hear anything about bad weather for the first quarter GDP flop here, did we? No, they didn't say anything about bad weather this time. I guess they've given up on that argument. Actually, the weather was extremely good, and we had a relapse anyway in the first quarter, relapse in GDP. And now we're seeing probably, to some extent, these low numbers are a reflection of the slowing of the economy. By the way, a lot of these jobs that have been created, they aren't full-time permanent jobs. Now, there's some, but a lot of them aren't. They're part-time temp jobs going on everywhere, not just in the U.S., but globally. We see the creation of these part-time temp contingent jobs, as we call it. And now we have this other big wave coming right behind, which is gig sharing economy jobs, which, of course, are also temp and often part-time. And that's going to take another whack. The gig economy, sharing economy, so-called, is going to devastate U.S. labor markets the same way that contingent jobs, part-time temp contract jobs, began to do in the 90s. And that's, of course, intensified. But now we got another wave. We have this wholesale restructuring, radical restructuring of labor markets by capitalists here in the 21st century. And that has a lot to do with the declining of incomes for folks in that category, particularly service jobs. You know, I mean, offshoring devastated by manufacturing jobs. We lost millions and millions of manufacturing jobs since Clinton for the offshoring. And, of course, that's begun to impact professional service jobs offshoring, too. The similar problem, similar in terms of the dimension problem, is now whacking service jobs, and that's the contingency. Certain industries, like retail and so forth, are almost all part-time temp jobs now. Well, part-time jobs, which is a way of avoiding paying benefits, you see. That's the response of corporate America to the escalating runaway cost of healthcare in this country. You know, they just hire people part time and they don't have to pay them, and that's why we have this poor solution called Obamacare to the whole thing. But it all begins under Bill Clinton. You know, runaway costs of healthcare, health insurance companies. And why do we have runaway health insurance companies? Because the pharmaceutical companies in particular and the health insurers, you know, they're all in bed with Wall Street. And they all want to buy up their competitors, not only in the U.S., but globally now. So they got to get money from Wall Street to make those acquisitions. Wall Street wants to ensure it's got a huge rate of return for that money, you know, and wants 20% rate of return. So it insists that these pharmaceutical and health insurance companies get a 20% rate of return. And by the way, Obamacare allows them still to get a 20% rate of return. Before that, it was like 22, 24% they were getting, so Obamacare put a 2% reduction on it. Big deal. That's the cause of the runaway healthcare prices, or the major cause. It's not that people are using healthcare more, or that the cost of machinery, technology is going up, which is true, all of that. But, you know, the big thing is these insurance companies got to gouge everybody, and the pharma companies, of course, we know, are gouging the hell out of everybody in order to get a rate of return to justify Wall Street and to be able to pay off their loans to Wall Street for their purchases of each other, right? So that's one of the reasons we got runaway costs in healthcare, and that's not stopping. USA economy continuing on this, they're trumpeting the fact that inflation rate is creeping up 1.5% for the PCE, personal consumption expenditure estimator. And that's supposed to be so good, you know. Oh, it shows the economy is getting stronger because demand, people have income, and demand for products is now driving up the prices of those products. So that's good. That's good. Well, you know, the devil's always in the detail. Look at, what's really driving the PCE. And it's not rising goods or income. Wage income or whatever, it's pretty much localized into rent costs going through the roof, particularly in urban settings here, driving up the PCE. The cost of housing, homes, which is mostly high-end housing, because there isn't an awful lot of low-end housing going on, or even medium-end homes being created. It's all high-end homes because there's a big demand for high-end homes. Wealthy folks have been distributed $5 trillion in the last 5 years from their corporations in terms of stock buybacks and dividend payouts. So they're all doing quite well and buying up. And we have this big influx of foreign money buying property in the United States now as the economies in China and elsewhere sag and don't look good long term. The rich folks there are sending their money out, and they're investing it in what they hope to be safe investments, and they think property is the safest investment. Very conservative investors are sending their money to the U.S. and buying up homes, especially on the West Coast and certain other cities. You can see this really going on. Okay. Also, healthcare costs are escalating now. Now that Obama is a lame duck of sorts, the health insurance companies and the health insurance industry in general is now jacking up its prices after Obamacare has been established for at least a year. Then we got oil prices, which bottomed out at $25 a barrel. And now we're back up into the mid-40, upper 40 range. And, of course, that's reflected as it passes through in gasoline and other areas in various price increases. So, you know, it's not really the U.S. economy that's growing so well, that people have so much more income on average, and therefore they're buying and driving up the price. Prices of real goods and services, no, the PCE 1.5 is really limited to certain areas which don't reflect necessarily growth. The rent situation don't reflect growth. Healthcare costs, oil is a global determinant here, etc. All right, so that's just a comment on that. Continuing on the U.S. economy, business investment continues to slide. This is a very important area because it stimulates the rest of the economy. And business investment, real investment, has been declining for 3 months in a row now. So how are we going to get a real growth here in the second quarter if business investment is on the rocks? Well, what about manufacturing? Well, manufacturing, durable goods, and so forth bounces up and down, but it's pretty stagnant here. If you look at U.S. Numbers, but if you look at what an independent source called Market PMI, manufacturing indicator, it shows that U.S. manufacturing is continuing to decline. And if the U.S. raises interest rates, that will raise the price of the dollar, and that will put more pressure, downward pressure on manufacturing in the U.S. What about construction? Well, construction is growing in apartments and high-end homes, but it's still only one-third of what it was in 2007. Okay, 2007 was a boom year, but even if you take a third off of 2007, construction growth is still only at one-third of one half of what it normally should be, and commercial construction is weakening fast. So the outlook longer term is not all that great for construction or manufacturing, sort of stagnant at best. But that's only 20% of the economy, granted. The big part of the economy is consumption, and the biggest part of that is called retail sales. All right, so retail sales look like it bounced back here last month after having trouble in the first quarter of this year. Well, you know, the spring is always an improvement because people get their IRS refunds and, you know, there's new spending that goes on in spring that's seasonal and so forth. So it appears to recover, and it does always. But, you know, one of an area that we really need to be worried about, and that is one of the biggest components driving retail sales is auto sales. And for several years now, auto sales have been really doing quite well because the auto companies are competing with each other intensely on discounts. And it was questioned about how long this could go on. At some point, you're going to get a saturation of the market, and we may have gotten close to that point because now, all of a sudden, in recent weeks, retail sales for automobiles have really plummeted. So it'd be interesting to see if this is a longer-term trend for autos and what that does for consumer spending. And consumer confidence, of course, is weakening. So it's a mixed picture in consumption, which is two-thirds of the economy in the U.S. At best, it's a weak picture. All of this productivity has stalled. Recently, this has become a real issue. U.S. Conference Board reported that U.S. productivity is growing about 0.2%, and forecast that it will turn negative very soon. This will be the first time that productivity turns negative, I think, in a half century. This is a portent of something very important going on, because if productivity is negative, that means business costs are rising, and they're not going to hire more people. That's a big question here for job creation and the U.S. economy, and they're really worried about that. It's not just a U.S. problem, it's a global problem as well. Going on in Europe, the OECD, which is a pan-European-wide research, government research body, is holding a conference this week and issued a report saying that productivity is only like 0.3% growth in Europe. This is a problem everywhere. Why is productivity a problem? Because businesses just aren't investing in new capital equipment, new business equipment. They're just not doing it. So the question, if real investment, as we call that, in equipment and structures and inventories and so forth, if real investment is slowing and declining, the rate of growth declining, and the productivity growth goes negative, that will go negative at some point. Why is that so? That's the main driver of the capitalist economy, investment. And if investment is not growing, you can keep consumption going for a little while by debt, people borrowing more and more. And that's what's been happening, too, for everybody except the top 10% households. It's debt-driven consumption, not wage-income growth consumption. Average wage growth appears to be positive, but that's average, and it's overweighted by those at the top, incomes doing quite well, but those at the median and below, stagnant or declining. So those at median or below have to rely on more debt in order to keep consumption and the standard of living going. All right. To sum up, then, it doesn't look really great for the U.S. economy, and I stand by my prediction that if it's not a recession this year, it certainly will be in 2017. You see, in election years, it's very difficult to get into a recession because government always pumps up the economy here in the few months before. My apologies about all this coughing. I've had a cold last week. I could not get over it and wasn't able to do a show, and I still have a bit of a lag going on here. So I'm having a little bit of problem of clearing my throat. If you want to read my assessment a few weeks ago, of the U.S. economy and in the wake of this first quarter problem, relapse, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. A few weeks ago, the article I wrote for Telesur Media out of South America, is Recession on the Horizon in the U.S.? And in that, I predict that, yes, a recession is on the horizon. It's not likely this year, but certainly will be no later than early next year. All right. Let's turn to other parts of the global economy and what's actually going on in the rest of the economy, as interesting as the U.S. as well, right? One of the big important indicators of what's happening globally is non-performing bank loans and negative interest rates. Negative interest rates, of course, are when government central banks charge, do not pay interest on government bonds if you want to buy a government bond, you have to pay the government issuer of the bond. You give them your money and you pay a fee to take for them to take your money. It's not as if, like in the U.S. where we don't have negative interest rates yet, you buy a government treasury bond and you may earn somewhere between 1% to 2.5%. Today, well, if you go to Europe and Japan, it's negative. It's negative. In other words, you got to pay the government to buy their bond. The whole idea here is, or at least one of the ideas of negative rates, is to force businesses to invest that money instead of having to pay the government to keep it safe, right? Well, one of the problems with all these negative bonds is that it is not generating recovery. It's not generating bank lending of any significance. Its intent is not working. But it is upsetting the whole interest rate scenario across the board, and bonds and loans and so forth. How big is this problem? Well, if you look at Europe and Japan, we don't even know how much in China, but over $10 trillion of bonds are now in negative territory. $10 trillion. And what's more important is that it's rising. The number of bonds, that sovereign bonds that are in negative territory, are rising about $500 billion a month. $500 billion. Non-performing bank loans globally are also well over $1 trillion, focused largely in the Eurozone, Japan, and in China. Non-performing loans. And we don't really know how much more of loans are non-performing in the emerging markets outside of China, probably trillions as well. non-performing loans are a big problem, because if they're not non-performing, means they're not paying a principal and interest that comes due. In other words, they are essentially in default. But the banks are not declaring them in default. To do so would send a serious red flag across the global economy. So they're allowing them to accumulate $10 trillion in non-performing, minimum $10 trillion, and over $10 trillion, and by some independent estimates, far more than $10 trillion, in global negative interest rates. These are all indicators of severe, severe problems in the global economy, particularly on the financial side. All right, at the same time, globally, real investment is declining or slowing, growth rate, big problem, and with it, productivity globally is slowing as well. And, you know, mainstream economists have no answer to this productivity conundrum. In fact, if you read the business page here, a headline in the Financial Times here last week was, the puzzle that baffles the world's economies, productivity. Why is productivity declining? They don't have an answer for this. They really don't know. Well, they don't have an answer for a lot of things now, increasingly. And I've been hammering on this whole question of mainstream economics and its inability to deal with and explain some of these conundrums globally. You know, why is real investment slowing? Why is productivity flat, stagnant, and declining? You know, what's happening? What's happening globally? That's just a short list. You know, my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, which you can go to my blog and my website and read some free chapters. Go to my website, kyklosproductions.com, K-Y-K-L-O-S productions.com, and you can read the introduction and a free chapter on China called Bubbles, Bubbles, Toil and Troubles of the book, which is now being translated, by the way, in Chinese. Understand my main argument there, and my main argument is that financial investment, the returns on financial asset investments, stocks, bonds, derivatives, Forex, and so forth, are so much greater in the short run that it's redirecting money capital that's pumped into the economy by the central banks, redirecting it into financial asset speculation. And that's why we see these bubbles all around the world. I mean, in China, you know, we know about the stock bubble that busted late last year. But the money has just either flowed out of China for a while until China kind of put the stops on that. Or it's flowed into new bubbles in China, new property bubbles there, and the new asset management bubbles going on in China. So, the money is just floating around from one financial market to the next, causing a bubble here, a bubble there, et cetera. Well, that's because financial asset investment is so much more profitable, and we have a global financial structure linked up by instantaneous money flows, no more controls on money capital flows between countries. Those were added in the 1980s. And on top of that, deregulation of the financial sector, and we have this new global financial structure of shadow banks, which, by the way, have penetrated both commercial banks and big multinational corporations, which are financial corporations now as well. So we got the shadow banking practices everywhere going on. That's the structure. And we have all these new financial securities that have been created, that the wealthy new global finance capital elite that's risen here in recent decades, about 200,000 of them globally, use these new highly liquid financial markets and these new securities, and you know, that's where a lot of the money capital growth is growing, and it's causing these bubbles. But it's also redirecting capital that might have gone into real investments that create jobs and incomes and so forth. And that's why we see, importantly, other factors, explanations, of course, but I think this is primary, why we see real investment declining globally, slowing down, declining. Of course, the collapse of oil and commodities has something to do with the collapse of investment. But, you know, you look at in the U.S. And Japan and Europe, banks aren't really lending that much to industries and companies that create real jobs. The money is going into finance, or it's going offshore to avoid paying taxes, or it was going to emerging markets for a while, or it's just being hoarded on bank balance sheets, which are, you know, have cash on hand greater than ever before. And that, of course, is true for multinationals and a lot of other companies as well. Huge cash hoards going on. And that's why they have to distribute. I mean, the cash hoards are so great that shareholders are saying, give me some, give me some. And that's why they're doing the stock buybacks and the dividend payouts, which, by the way, in the U.S. amounted to $5 trillion in the last 5 years. Yeah, the stock market's more than doubled, bond market's more than doubled, and boy, they just funneled that money back to their big shareholders, $5 trillion. Well, no wonder we have income inequality. You know, wages are stagnant or falling for those who earn their living, wages and so forth. At the same time, we have this escalating capital gains, and since George Bush, the tax structure had been, quote, reformed in order to allow that to pass through to the wealthy. And so we got income inequality that's being driven at both ends. You know, we have wages that are very stagnant, pretty much, except for the top 10% of the labor force. And then we have escalating capital gains, which they're able to keep, stock and bond buybacks and other forms of speculation. You know, you got lopsided developments going on both ends. But, you know, if you listen to mainstream economists, they don't talk much about the financial end and capital gains escalation. Oh, they may mention a CEO pay, but that's, you know, a small part of the total distribution going to shareholders. It's this distribution that's really the key. So we got this income inequality going on both ends. By the way, some mainstream economists are beginning to wonder that, well, maybe inequality has something to do with low productivity. They're struggling to find out the connections between them. But the connection has to do on the financial side, I think. The same thing that's driving inequality, financial asset investment and speculation is the same thing that's redirecting and diverting investment money into financial markets instead of into real goods and development that would require the hiring of people and therefore raise real wages. But the problem is mainstream economists don't have much of an understanding of the financial side. You know, they can't see it. I recently wrote an article here for European Financial Review, which will come out in their next issue. And entitled, Why Economists Fail to Understand Financial Instability. I will put that up on my blog and website when it is published in the next few weeks. You know, I take on mainstream economists, which I don't think very much of here, and indicate, you know, why don't they understand this? Right. Why can't they see the financial side? Well, because of a number of reasons. One, they're not trained in financial analysis and financial variables. You see, they're trained in what's called the National Income and Product Accounts, NIPA, or GDP. And by definition, GDP excludes financial variables. By the way, interest rates are not financial variables. They are proxy representations of financial and real variables, but they aren't financial per se themselves. And mainstream economists, of course, do pay attention to interest rates, but only by looking at some of the real causes behind interest rates, some of them don't even do that, and excluding any consideration of financial forces affecting interest rates. That's why they don't understand why low and zero and negative interest rates are not stimulating real investment. As I said before, all these low rates are doing is funneling the money into financial speculation and financial asset investment because it's more profitable. Okay. So we have the training of mainstream economists is in real variables, you know, real indicators, GDP indicators, and this is their whole training, their whole background, and they don't understand financial cycles. They're just concerned with real business cycles, but real cycles are influenced by financial cycles. Now, you can't deny this, but they aren't trained in looking at that data and trying to understand how that data interacts with the real side of the U.S. and global economy. And, of course, they establish their careers on ideas and building models based on real variables. And there's a kind of a conservative inertia among academic economists to consider new thoughts and ideas that fundamentally challenge their old paradigms, you see, their old way of doing analysis. If you're a young academic and you try to do so, you're really discouraged from doing so. You've got to show in academia how your ideas are really just an extension of previously accepted thinking. Well, if the previous models and theories are fundamentally wrong, you can't do that, right? Except to fundamentally criticize those old views and perspectives, which won't get you very far in terms of an academic career. Right. Your articles will not get produced in the peer-review journals or get past the committees. Promotions won't follow. Your job security becomes problematic. Right. So there's big pressures to engage in what some decades ago the philosopher Thomas Kuhn called mopping up operations or normal science instead of a breakthrough thinking that may challenge especially prevailing paradigms and acceptable modes of thought. An example of this is with regard to productivity. You know, there's a great book that I recommend on its own limited basis by Robert Gordon, called The Rise and Fall of the American of American Growth, almost totally looking at just real forces behind ways of technology creation in U.S. economic history and so forth, that has been responsible for economic growth. And what Gordon basically argues is that economic growth today is just not there, and productivity is flat and declining as a consequence. Good productivity is primarily driven by investment, but it's not there. Well, I won't go into all of his arguments, but basically he looks at the real forces that are responsible, real indicators, variables, for this decline of growth and productivity. But he doesn't consider financial forces and variables. It's a big problem, right? Once again, it's their training. They have no way of really understanding what they are ignorant about, which is mostly on the finance side, financial variables. Oh, there were a few economists, mainstream economists, who did so in the past, like Hyman Minsky, James Tobin, and others. their work was either marginalized in the case of Minsky, or it was not really generalized in the case of Tobin. In other words, generalized, the new generation of academic economists did not pick up and really run with some of these ideas. And those who today, since 2008, are attempting to do so, are nonetheless encouraged to go off into their own separate institutes, or maybe congregate in a department here or there, academic department at some university here or there, and they're kept on the margin, safely isolated from mainstream communications and journals and so forth. So, you know, the initial training of mainstream economic economists today, whole generation, two generations, the type of data they employ, just GDP real variables, the models built upon them, conservative career pressures, and the intellectual preoccupations of economics discipline itself keeps them all from considering financial variables and financial instability, except on the fringe, you see. And that's why they can't forecast what's going on, you know, terrible forecasting of financial crises and financial instability events, and because the financial side now is driving the real side, increasingly so, they can't understand what's going on. All they can do is, you know, their financial business school folks, they talk about fat tail events, right? The way of just conceptualizing surprises they don't predict, you see. a theory about how they don't have theories to forecast any of this stuff. But let's turn to the rest of the global economy here and talk more about that. All right, so we already mentioned globally non-performing bank loans, big problem. Globally, $10 trillion plus of negative interest rates and growing at $500 billion a month. China. We've talked about China. It says officially it's growing 6.7%. Not true. Barely growing, barely 4 to 5%, I would say. Bubbles, you know, recycling of bubbles going on. China has pumped tens of trillions of dollars, well, dollar equivalents, yuans, and so forth, but some foreign currency as well, to pump up its economy since 2010. Prior to that, there were no shadow banks in China. Now it's a big problem. Shadow banks, man, independent investors that they have a hard time controlling here from speculative activity. We saw the pumping up of the stock market in 2014-15. Doubling it, and the value is collapsing, crashing. They're back down where they are now, before the bubble. Well, where did all that money capital created by that bubble go? Well, it went, one, into these new bubbles here of new property, a bubble into asset management product bubble, And a lot of the money started flowing out of China, and big problem with capital flight, and of course that drives down the value of the Chinese currency, which is pegged and arranged to the dollar. But as capital flight occurs, the pressure grows on the Chinese currency, the yuan, to devalue even further. And China's doing everything it can to prevent that devaluation because it has a deal with the West here to accept the yuan as a global reserve currency. So it can't allow that currency to fluctuate too much. Whenever it looks like the yuan's going to devalue even below that range, acceptable range, that it's instituted, pegged to the dollar range, what China does is intervene to keep it back within the range, but it has to spend hundreds of billions of its current of its foreign exchange reserves to do that, and it has to spend hundreds of billions to discourage capital flight as well. So these are problems. Imminent devaluation, which is going to occur, it's going to break out of that range of its currency, yuan, you know, eventually, and that will set off red flags in global currency markets, particularly in Asia, when that happens. But it's not imminent here yet. Capital flight is a problem out of China, and it's continuing. And, of course, in the meantime, we have China trying to get its economy reversed in terms of the direction of its growth, slowing growth, and stimulating fiscal, many fiscal policies, stimulus, but massive increases in liquidity. Also, there's a problem with the state-owned enterprises, you know, the old line enterprises, steel and mining and so forth, which are trillions of dollars. These companies are technically bankrupt. And the government has been pumping in money and continues to to enable these companies to continue paying their debt, which had risen significantly, to prevent them from actual bankruptcy. But technically, they are bankrupt. So we have a big problem with massive tens of trillions of dollars, $25 trillion by some estimates, of debt run-up in China in the last quarter. Not quarter, but last 5 years. And state-owned and old-line industry bankruptcies. We got rotating bubbles going on. We got capital flight. We got currency pressuring downward and so forth. So a lot of problems in China. And I predicted the next global financial crash will emerge initially in China. China will, because of its huge currency reserves, stabilize it, check it. But it won't be able to check the contagion effects, which will spread to emerging markets in a major way, and from there to the Eurozone and finally to the U.S. I think that's that's the route some of this is going to occur when it does happen. But I don't think it'll happen this year. We'll see what happens next year with it. The big thing on the horizon here for the Eurozone is this Brexit, the U.K. exit. From the Eurozone that's going on here at a vote on June 23rd. And the capitalists, particularly in the UK, are becoming a little bit panic-stricken here because polls show that, well, people maybe may vote for the Brexit, leaving the Euro, European Union, the UK, which is really... has its origins in David Cameron's run for office that last time, promising people, really bashing Europe in order to get elected, and saying, committing to this kind of a vote. A vote for me will commit to that. Well, that pushed him over the top in the election, but now this Faustian bargain that he's made is coming home to roost. And now we have this this vote going on coming up on June 23rd. I'll be writing about it, of course, for Telesaur, and we will post that on jackrasmus.com. So my analysis of that, stay tuned. But I did write about it last year, last summer, when the whole issue arose at the time of Greece promising maybe to exit a Grexit. You know, that was an issue during last year's Greek debt negotiations and crisis. Grexit. I said, well, Brexit is here as well. And both of them will converge next summer, which is this summer right now. And if they converge together, that could have a major consequence. To prevent that convergence, by the way, is why the IMF and the European Commission pushed forward this issue of the Greek debt crisis, which is still very much ongoing. And I've been talking about that. Go to my blog for some comments on the IMF and the EC, and the latest article I wrote on that, how the IMF and the Troika being the IMF, European Central Bank, and European Commission, finance ministers in the Eurozone, how the Troika outmaneuvered Syriza, the Greek party, and still in control, a rump Syriza, by the way. Many progressives have left Syriza. How they outmaneuvered them again in this recent negotiation, got even more austerity out of the Greeks, and now I notice the latest report here is that the ECB is balking at releasing the funds, 7.5 billion euros here due in July, to prevent a default on the Greek government loans. You see, all this, all these loans and these Greek debt crises are really all about extracting more austerity out of the Greeks in order to give them more loans to pay the interest on the loans that the Troika gave them in the past. That's what it's all about. It's not loans to Greece to help Greece get out of depression. It's loans to Greece so they can continue paying the Troika. Right? They're just recycling money to themselves going on. And the latest way that they tricked the Greeks, Syriza, once again, is to say that, oh, we may give you some debt relief, you know, squeeze your workers and your society once more with more austerity, and we'll give you some debt relief. Well, you know, Syriza lined up with the IMF on that, because the IMF is saying, well, there's no way Greeks can pay this back, and it's true, you know, you got to give them some debt relief. So Syriza tightened its belt on austerity even more, hoping to get some debt relief. But what they got was a vague promise saying that in 2018 they'll look at debt relief, maybe. Yeah, sure they will. The IMF and others wanted to get the possibility of this debt crisis in Greece off the table before the Brexit came up, and also Spanish elections, where left party Podemos is challenging here, see. That was why this thing all came up early with Greece, and prevent a Grexit at the time the Brexit might occur this summer as well. Because if, you know, this whole thing with Greece and exit might have come up once again in July when this next 7.5 billion euro debt payment is due. Well, the deal was, we're going to loan you more money here, Greece, so you can pay the $7.5 billion, but you're going to squeeze yourself some more austerity, right? And we'll let you think about debt relief sometime later down the road here, a couple years from now. Right. So Grexit is off the table, and you're not going to get a conversion of Grexit and Brexit at the same time that I predicted last summer. But Brexit, British, UK exit, is not off the table, and the polls are beginning to swing in the direction of British voters voting to exit. And it's got them all panicked, you see, because if that happens, British banks, finance capital, which is, you know, this is about all Britain really has left is finance capital. Excuse me. They're going to be denied some access to the Eurozone, and certainly there won't be as much exports to the Eurozone from the UK to the Eurozone. So, you know, a lot of trade related lending and by British banks will not happen, at least in the short run. In the longer run, it's not a problem, but they don't, you know, Britain's not kept its head above water with a false construction boom here for in foreign capital, courting the Chinese that pumped capital into London infrastructure and so forth, and that can't be sustained much longer. In fact, Britain is slowing down now. And if this Brexit thing comes on top of it, it will definitely mean a short-term recession in the UK with consequences, who knows, for the rest of the Eurozone. So they're all panicking over there, the bankers in London. And, of course, Cameron is panicking. But, you know, even if the vote goes against it, I predict what's going to happen is if they don't manipulate the vote as they did with the Scottish independence, they won't implement the exit, the Brexit, and they'll find a way to put it to another vote at some point. They'll just, you know, suspend everything and try to figure out a new strategy to prevent the exit. Too much money involved for a big capitalist here. They're not going to allow this to happen. All right, so what else is happening? Well, Japan, we just had the G7, Big Seven Economies of the World meeting in Japan last week, and Shinzo Abe, the prime minister, is really panicking over there. He even raised the possibility that, you know, what we're looking at is another Lehman Brothers-like event, as he put it, you know. And, of course, no one in the other G6... I jumped on that idea. I mean, to say that that's a reality will actually help deliver the reality will panic people, investors. So, you know, the rest of the G7 were hush-hush on that. But Japan is a basket case, you see. Far greater debt to GDP in Japan than almost anywhere else. I think it's well over 200%. Worse than Greece, I think. And negative interest rates, major problem over there, right? And, you know, all this liquidity pumping, QEs and so forth for years has not stimulated the recovery in Japan. They've had five recessions here in the last 5-6 years. And the hope was that, you know, going negative interest rates and more QE and would lower the currency exchange rate and stimulate exports. Well, currency exchange rate, the yen, is rising despite all this massive injection of liquidity by the central banks. By the way, Japan's central bank, Bank of Japan, is not only buying government bonds, but for a while now has been buying corporate bonds and even stocks. What does this all mean when the central banks buy up all of these financial securities? You know, and now Europe, the European Central Bank just announced here this past week it was going to start buying corporate bonds as well. Well, this means that capitalism is in deep doo-doo here when the government has to buy all their financial securities to keep the price up. All right, we'll talk about it again next week. This is Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus.